Birthday Dinner, a novel by Jeffrey Anderson, Part 12, read by the author. On the clear, hot Saturday morning, Zach and Becca decided to take their landlord up on his offer of a day's use of his double-wide parked on a waterfront lot at Bodie Lake, the state's largest man-made reservoir. The lot about an hour's drive north of Shefford along a thinly traveled interstate, and then a few miles of country roads. Becca's first impulse was to call Mrs. Brackett to see if Jonah wanted to join them, but she suppressed that initial urge. Jonah was safe with his great-grandmother and well supplied with art projects and weekend reading assignments from Mrs. Anders. This day would be for her and Zach. They hurried about the small kitchen like excited school kids before a field trip and threw together a lunch commensurate to that theme, diagonally sliced peanut butter and jelly sandwiches with store-bought white bread, potato chips in pleated plastic bags, seedless white grapes washed and wrapped in paper towels, and four bottles of cream soda buried in ice in a small red and white cooler. Becca closed the bedroom door before slipping into her one-piece bathing suit, and Zach wondered about this sudden modesty. After a couple minutes, he tapped on the door. "Yes," Becca said. "You okay?" The door swung partway open. "Couldn't be better," she said, as she stepped back and pulled on her shorts over the bathing suit and tucked in the pale blue t-shirt. "Why?" Zach took two strides forward and hugged her with all his strength. "Because I love you," he said. "Not too tight," she said, and squirmed in his embrace. He relaxed his arms but kept them loosely wrapped around her. "And I also do as I'm told," she laughed. "Then you won't throw me in the water if I'm not ready." He reached down, grabbed her around the hips, and tossed her over his shoulder. "What about when you are ready?" he said. He carried her into the kitchen, then the living room, as if prowling around for some body of water to toss her in. She giggled into his shoulder and lightly pounded on his back with her fist. "Zach, let me down," she cried, though, like a long-ago schoolgirl she once again was, she hoped against her plea that this frisky boy would never set her down. The double-wide shoehorn between two behemoth pines was adequate to their needs, a place to park the car, stow their lunch, pee, freshen up as needed. But the tidy, sandy beach on a picturesque cove and the clear, cool water sparkling under the blue skies and bright sun, that was far better than they'd expected or dared to hope. It certainly wasn't the ocean, lacking the waves, the incessant sound of surf, the salt scent, the pesky gulls, but it was darned good enough, in some ways even better than the ocean, calmer, more private, no human visible along the tree-dotted shoreline, undulating in either direction. A human-scale, big water shore, only without the humans. What more could they ask for? Zach posed that exact question to Becca after they'd spread their blanket, then towels on the white imported sand. After she'd laid down on her stomach in the sun on one of those towels, and he'd taken a quick swim in the cool but not cold water, doing a series of backward somersaults in the clear water, then reversing his spin and doing a longer series of forward somersaults, glimpsing the sun at the peak of each loop before descending again into the dim deep to rise to the sun time and again, embracing with youthful joy the water and the sun and the day and his life. "What more could we ask for?" he said to her in the blue-dominated setting after sitting on the other towel with his arms resting on his wet knees and staring across the small cove and into the broad channel to the trees on the far side of the lake. Becca closed the paperback Dune and laid the side of her face on the warm towel, looking up at him with one open eye, the other hidden below. "We could ask for time to stop," she said. He thought about that a minute, then nodded slowly. "For how long?" "Oh, about 1,000 years, she said. "And then we resume where we left off?" "No, we're 1,000 years smarter. The world's 1,000 years better." "Or worse," Zach said. Becca closed her one eye and nestled her face into the soap-scented towel, backed by the soft blanket, backed by the soft sand. "Don't say that, Zach. Don't even think it," she whispered into the towel. Zach turned around and lay on his stomach beside her, let his face slowly slide along the soft cloth till it came up against and nuzzled her lotion-scented neck. "Will your skin be 1,000 years drier?" "Mmm," she cooed. "Mummy-dried skin with sunk-in cheeks and a sharp-edged jaw with big yellow teeth sticking out under dark holes for eyes." Zach lapped lightly at the moist and incredibly soft skin beside his lips. "Then you know what I think," he said. "What?" "Before you freeze time for 1,000 years, "Yes?" she asked. "The one thing we absolutely must do..." "Whisper it to me, Mr. Always Horny and Can't Ever Get Enough," she said. "Is roll your 20-year-old body over..." "Yes," she cooed as he slid his hands under her thighs and breasts and gently rolled her over. "And slide my 24-year-old hands here." He slid one hand up under her butt as she raised her thighs slightly to give him better access. "Okay," she said. "And then here..." And he slid his other hand up under her shoulders and around her neck. "I like where this is heading," she said. "And I lower my face to your young and warm and expectant lips." "Sounds better by the minute," she said, her eyes closed the whole time. "And just before I touch my lips to your soft, ruby-colored lips of youth and vitality, "yes?" "I pass my lips close to your ear. Tell me," she said, "and whisper that if we're going to be frozen for 1,000 years, then I might as well say, I'm waiting. It's time to... please throw you in the water whether you're ready or not." She screamed as he picked her up and cradled her in his arms and ran best he could across the narrow beach and splashed out into the water still holding her and stumbled and splashed still holding her, refusing to let her go, and Becca screaming and laughing hysterically the whole time till he finally stopped in chest-deep water, still holding her in his arms, and her screams and laughter stopped as his lips locked on hers. And he simply wouldn't part from there as he spun slowly, eyes closed, in the brilliant flashing stars inside their heads, and the one brilliant star outside their heads, and the world of blue with seconds passing into minutes passing into 1,000 years, though their welded lips remained soft and pliant that whole time. Chapter 2 of Part 12. Becca woke with a start in the middle of the night and grabbed the receiver off the phone and pulled it to her ear. "Hello? Me back." She sat bolt upright. "What's the matter, Jonah?" she shouted into the phone. "Me back." The line went dead. "Jonah!" Becca shouted into the receiver. "Jonah!" A dial tone filled the silence in her ear. Becca jumped out of bed without turning on the light and started to pull on the jeans she draped over the chair before going to bed. "What's up, Beck?" Zach said sleepily, his head still in the pillows. "It's Jonah," she said. "Something's wrong." Zach sat up and scrubbed at his eyes. "What's wrong?" "I don't know. He just said my name, then hung up or had the phone taken away. I don't know, Zach. Something's wrong." She tried to put on the t-shirt by feel and got it backwards. "Can I please turn on the light?" she shouted. "Sure, Beck, go ahead." By now, he was out of the bed and moving around to where she was standing in front of the dresser in the dark. The lamp on the nightstand came on with a blinding brilliance. Becca had her jeans on and a bra and quickly straightened the t-shirt and slid it on over her head and arms. Zach came around and slid between her and the dresser. He put his hands on her shoulders and tried to fix on her eyes with his still somewhat clouded by sleep. "Calm down, Becca. Tell me what happened." She took a deep breath. "It was Jonah on the phone. He said my name twice, then the line went dead. He sounded terrified." "How do you know it was him?" Zach asked. "I recognized his voice, Zach. I know his voice, and he called me Beck." Zach nodded. "So what are you going to do?" He checked the clock on the nightstand. It was 2:12 in the morning. "I'm going to Mrs. Brackett's," Becca said. Whoa, Beck, wait a minute. You can't go over there in the middle of the night." "Why not?" "That's a war zone after dark. Besides, you don't even know if that's where he is." "I don't know anywhere else to look, Zach." Her hands and shoulders were shaking violently. Zach hugged her, then guided her to a seat on the edge of the bed. "Sit here a minute. Take a few deep breaths," he suggested. "We've got to do something, Zach." "I know. We will. If you'll promise to stay put a minute, I'm going to call Mrs. Brackett's house." Becca nodded. "Okay." She took a long, deep breath and held it in her lungs before releasing it in a drawn out and slow exhalation. Zach went to the kitchen and dialed Mrs. Brackett's number that was taped beside the wall phone. He let the phone on the other end ring 12 times before hanging up, each plaintive ring like a groan of increasing intensity in his heart, not for Jonah or Mrs. Brackett, but for Becca gasping for air beside him. He returned to the bedroom. No answer. "She says her phone sometimes doesn't work, Zach." If Jonah was calling from there, then it was working. Becca nodded. "So maybe he's not there." Zach shrugged. "Maybe not, but it's a place to start. Even if he's not there, she might know where he is." He took his jeans off the hook on the closet door and put them on. "Maybe we should call the police," Becca said. "And tell them what? That you think you got a call from a boy no relation to you? And he might be in trouble, but we don't know where he is or what kind of trouble it is he might be in?" Becca nodded. "So what should we do?" Zach said, "I'll drive by Mrs. Brackett's house." "Zach!" Zach raised his hand to stop her protest. "I won't even get out of the truck if there's any hint of trouble. I'll just drive by and take a look. In the meantime, you keep trying her number and stay near the phone in case Jonah calls again. And I'm just sitting here waiting. You're here if Jonah calls. You're trying Mrs. Brackett's number. And what if you don't come back? If I'm not back in half an hour or call you from Mrs. Brackett's to say everything is okay, then call the police and send them over there. Becca nodded. I hate sending you out there. It's not your fight. It's ours, Zach said, as he finished tying his work boots. She nodded in resignation. Be careful, Zach, she said, not rising from her seat on the bed, feeling all but paralyzed with fear and confusion and doubt. I always am, he said. He leaned across the bed and kissed the top of her head. I love you. You too, Becca said, barely a whisper. Chapter 3 of Part 12. The street was totally deserted and totally dark. In all his earlier visits, Zach had failed to notice the lack of streetlights, but now their absence was all too apparent and ominous as he turned off the paved road. He downshifted into first gear, a creeper gear designed for field work, and the truck moved forward at a crawl. Not only was the street dark, but so were all the houses. This made sense for the numerous structures that were boarded up or vacant, but even the occupied houses were not marked by even a nightlight's glow. He tried to remember which houses were occupied, then realized he couldn't. This late at night, they were all the same. To a carload of punks driving by with guns pointed or bricks to throw, they were all equal, all dead, all seeming deserted. He slowly approached Mrs. Brackett's house on the one side, Snake's on the other. Both of them were dark, too. He wished his headlights had a wider spread, so he could better see around each house. But their glow only reached a little ways off the road and showed nothing along the houses' sides or backyards. To get a fuller view, he'd have to angle the truck in the road and shine his lights directly at the house, and he chose not to disrupt the peace and quiet of the setting through such an aggressive action, an action that might prompt a call to the police or a volley of gunshots. He reached the dead end of the road a quarter mile farther on, littered with more trash than the county landfill, and looking especially forsaken in the limited reach of his truck's lights. He turned around, careful not to run over a discarded mattress, and headed back the way he'd come, at that same creeping speed. As he came up on Mrs. Brackett's house from the other direction, the bedroom side, he was praying to see some glimmer of light through those gable-end windows. But there was nothing. He could barely make out the end of the house from the surrounding night. Then he recalled how Becca had said Jonah's windows were all taped over with dark paper. There's no way he'd know from outside if anyone were inside. As he crept past the house, his first thought was to keep going. Drive on home and wait for morning. It wasn't but a few hours away. To try to sort this all out. But then he imagined Becca's face after telling her he hadn't found Jonah and didn't even know if he were at Mrs. Brackett's or not. He couldn't bear that sadness, that confusion, that desperation. He directed the creeping truck to the side of the road, just beyond the house, the spot where he and Becca always parked when visiting, though facing in the opposite direction and then dark, black as pitch now. He switched off the engine and cut the lights. He closed his eyes to let his pupils adjust to the darkness behind his lids, hoping it might be just a little darker than the darkness outside the lids, that his eyesight so adjusted might extract more from his surroundings. And when he opened his eyes, it did seem he could see better, perceive more from the night. The edge of the road as it threaded off toward the main road, the silhouette of the abandoned house on the next lot ahead, and the leaning mailbox on the far side of the gravel track. He reached into the glove compartment for the flashlight that was always there and discovered it missing. He immediately recalled last using it while clearing the clogged drain under Snake's kitchen sink. It must still be in that cabinet, just yards from where he sat, but useless to him now. He shook his head, more troubled by his negligence at forgetting to collect the flashlight than at its absence. All his life, through childhood, adolescence, and young adulthood, he'd prowled the night alone, spying on unsuspecting friends in his neighborhood, hunting foxes, roaming deserted Boston alleyways. And he'd never carried a flashlight, felt that such artificial light would be an affront to the enfolding night, and would only draw attention to his presence. So he didn't have a flashlight now. That was a small concern. He could see what he had to see. Mrs. Brackett could add artificial light or not, as she saw fit, once he knocked at her door. He stepped out into the night and closed the door to his truck gently till he heard the latch click. He was surprised at how well he could see and wondered if some source of light had been added without his noticing. A cloud cleared from in front of the moon, a pre-dawn glow from the eastern sky, some back porch light he'd missed. He looked about but discovered no source whatever for the light that guided his way. He shrugged to himself, by now was completely comfortable in the night, felt an old kinship in this new setting. He turned and walked slowly but confidently toward Mrs. Brackett's front door, using silent Indian steps, his heel-to-toe footfalls making virtually no sound on the rough gravel. He reached the porch steps and was just starting to consider whether it would be better to knock on the door or call out through the thin walls, when the club hit him squarely on the left side of his face. He fell hard to the porch floor, in that initial instant, as much shocked by this treachery out of the old familiar night as by the blow itself. Then the club glanced off his shoulder and hit the other side of his face as he tried to sit up. The back of his head cracked against the porch floor. The porch light came on in a split second's clarity of sight and awareness that was really more a frozen snapshot of vision than any perceived sense of time-propelled motion. Zach saw an unfamiliar black man standing over him with a baseball bat. LaTanya, with a gleaming small knife in her hand, behind that man, and a voice. The word was part of this snapshot, frozen in time with shape and dimension. A voice saying, "No," firmly, absolutely. Zach didn't see the muzzle flash or hear the boom that followed. He'd fallen beyond the time-driven order of things. The end of part 12 of Birthday Dinner.